Case number 09-3117, United States of America v. Daniel Wright, appellant. Ms. Rowland for the appellant, Ms. Bates for the appellee.
Good morning.
May it please the court, Sandra Rowland on behalf of Daniel Wright. Representing co-defendants in the same case does not necessarily present a conflict of interest. If, for example, the co-defendant's defenses were aligned, there might not be any actual conflict or any adverse effect on counsel's performance. However, when an attorney represents co-defendants whose interests are not aligned, they accuse each other, and the attorney's loyalties are divided, the defendant's right to counsel is violated. Mr. Wood's loyalties were divided in this case. As he informed the district court, he had a continuing duty to protect Mr. Washington's confidences.
Mr. Wright was aware of this conflict, wasn't he?
He was aware because it was discussed in open court.
Right, right.
Yes.
Yeah, and in open court he was asked by Judge Robertson whether he voluntarily agreed to the plea agreement. He was in fact asked whether he had been put under any pressure. And his answer was no, right?
Correct. The rule there's,
but doesn't that gut your the way you've tried to frame this case? As I understand it, you're arguing that because of this possible conflict, trial counsel pressured him into a plea agreement to avoid trial.
Yes.
So what are we to make of, I mean, there's lots of authority, not necessarily in our circuit yet, lots of authority that there's a heavy presumption of validity that comes from those plea colloquies. They're made under oath and so forth. Anyway.
We have no issue with the plea colloquy, and he did say falsely that he had not been pressured. In fact, there was an actual conflict that adversely affected Mr. Wood's ability to take the case to trial, and so Mr. Wright had no other choice. Mr. Wood could not take this case to trial because of his duties to Mr. Washington. If the government had called Washington as a witness, as the government might well have done, since its theory against my client aligned perfectly with Washington's testimony, Mr. Wood would not have been able to cross-examine
Washington. You didn't raise that point in your brief, the point you just made.
What we did in our brief was argue that the conflict of interest prevented Wood from taking the case to trial, where the conflict would have come to the forefront and Wood would have had to have withdrawn from the case.
Now, but you didn't say that he would have called Washington, or that Washington would be a witness, that the government would call Washington, and that
Wood
couldn't cross-examine him. It's not in your brief. I looked for it. It's not there.
It's,
let me ask you what. Well, on page 16 and 17 of your brief, you say that your client had no intention of pleading guilty. He intended to put the government to its burden of proof, particularly pointing out to the judge and jury that the contraband that he allegedly tossed into the car was found in a side panel. And since following disclosure of Wood's conflict, however, Wood pressured the appellant to give up his right to trial. There's not a single citation to anything in the record to back up those statements. Where do you get them from?
Well, those statements are largely actually superfluous because
my first question, whether they're superfluous or not, where do you get where's the evidence to support any of that?
From my client, Mr. Wright states he did not hire Doug Wood to get him a plea deal, which it actually wasn't a deal, but in order to plead guilty.
This is from your conversations with your client? Is that what you're telling us?
Yes. These are his assertions on appeal. But he doesn't actually need to assert those things because where a lawyer has divided loyalties and actual conflict, you don't look at any sort of prejudice. Well, would he have actually gone to trial? Would he have won the trial? How strong was the evidence? You don't look at that. You look simply at...
Well, what we have in terms of evidence is not your client talking to you, but talking to the court under oath saying, number one, that he jumped out of the car when it was moving at a slow speed, which corresponds with what he told the police when he was originally arrested. And number two, that he started running. And number three, that he threw a bag back into the automobile. All of those correspond and tally with what he told the police at the time, years ago. In addition, he swore under oath that he knew that the bag that he threw back into the car contained contraband.
Yes, he did make that under oath representation. At sentencing, he actually...
There's no allegation, even in the unsupported or no records, no allegation that the defense attorney told him to lie, is it? Is there?
No. Our contention is that Mr. Wood could not take this case to trial because he had an actual conflict. He had divided loyalties in a case where the defendants are pointing the finger at each other. And so he pressured Mr. Wright. He left Mr. Wright no alternative. We cannot take this case to trial. I can't do it. And so he pled guilty. At his sentencing, he did say that the drugs were not his. So he did renege.
No, he didn't renege because the only the questions he was asked at the plea were not whether they were his, but whether he knew that the bag that he threw back into the car would contain the drugs.
No, at sentencing, he said that the drugs were not his.
No, I know at sentencing. I'm talking about the plea.
Oh, yes. Well, I was just pointing out that he did say that they weren't his later.
Why does the Sullivan standard even apply in this case, given what the Supreme Court said in Mickens?
Are you referring to the question of successive representation?
Mm-hmm.
This is not a case of successive representation. Successive representation is when the lawyer has represented the victim or a witness or a co-defendant in a previous unrelated case.
Mm-hmm.
When it's the exact same case, although it's odd in this circumstance because they were tried so many years apart,
mm-hmm.
It isn't what people refer to as successive representation. It's multiple representation.
It's not concurrent representation.
It's not concurrent, but that's not what Sullivan hinges on. He represented a man who said, Wright did it. Wright says Washington did it. He holds Washington's confidences and his duty of loyalty to Washington, which are not extinguished by the fact that Washington's case is over. So whether Washington was called as a witness by the government or whether he himself called Washington to testify, as he would expect truthfully, that the drugs did not belong to Wright, that they belonged to Washington or to Early. He couldn't use those confidences in direct examination. If Washington became a hostile witness, he couldn't cross-examine on this. He was hampered in his representation of Mr. Wright because of his loyalties to Mr. Washington. That is an actual conflict, and I think in all of these cases, certainly where there was a guilty plea, it's going to be the case that the defendant said what he had to say in order to end the case short of trial, and that should not prevent this court from looking at the adverse effect of this actual conflict on Mr. Wright. I think in Sullivan, the defendants were not tried together. They were tried separately, presumably one after another. And so this case is unusual since they were tried 16 or 17 years apart. But I don't think the lapse of time makes any difference.
Can I ask you one thing? Why did you say this is not a successive representation case? I thought successive representation, courts have said, occurs where defense counsel has previously represented a co-defendant or trial witness.
In a different case.
Yeah, you're saying in a different case.
Right.
Okay. So in the same case, you're saying, or the same, not case, but the
right.
same transaction.
If Mr. Wood had represented Mr. Washington in an entirely different case, his confidences, everything he told Wood in that case, wouldn't make any difference.
Well, you don't know that. Right?
Well, we don't know that, but that's a potential conflict.
Right.
And that's a different issue. This is an actual conflict where Washington, at least in his testimony, said Wright did it. Mm-hmm. And Wright's defense is, no, Washington did it, or Early did it.
What was the ground of the appeal?
Mr. Washington and Mr. Early both raised sufficiency. Actually, I'm not sure if Mr. Early raised sufficiency of the evidence, but Mr. Washington did raise sufficiency of the evidence. And the court held that his own testimony that although Mr. Wright had the bag and threw the bag into the car, his testimony that he grabbed the bag and put it in the door panel was sufficient to show that he aided and abetted Mr. Wright's possession of the drugs. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal time for me. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Lauren Bates on behalf of Appellee of the United States. Here, the trial record forecloses the possibility of an actual conflict of interest, that is, a conflict of interest that had an adverse effect here. I think one thing that has not been discussed yet in the argument is that appellant was represented by conflict-free counsel in this case, as well as Mr. Wood. Conflict-free counsel, Jennifer Wicks, appeared and handled the plea proceedings in this case. She had also handled a status hearing that occurred before a plea offer was ever extended in this case. She appeared on January 30th, 2009. Any conflict here would have been cured by the representation of conflict-free counsel. And the record conclusively shows that there was no pressure placed on appellant to accept a guilty plea in this case.
Did the judge actually ask that question, whether you were pressured to plead? I thought he just went through the factual basis and then said that I find that the plea is voluntarily given.
The judge did ask whether the plea was voluntary and then asked a question that was, did anyone force or coerce you to accept the plea in this case? During the Rule 11 colloquy, and then asked, are you satisfied with the representation of...
Now that you say that, I know the Rule 11 requires the judge to ask whether the defendant was forced or coerced, right? I don't think the judge asked that in this case.
Yeah. I believe that the judge did, and with court's brief indulgence, if I can find that. I believe the court asked, thank you, on page
14
at the bottom, yes, thank you. Mr. Wright, has anybody forced you, pressured you, or coerced you in any way to accept this plea of guilty? Sir. No, sir. Are you pleading guilty voluntarily and of your own free will? Yes, sir. Are you satisfied with the services of your attorneys? Yes, sir. And here, there's...
Did he say attorneys in plural?
The judge did, Your Honor. And that is because there were, as Ms. Wicks stated at the beginning of the plea proceedings, she had also joined to represent appellant to be conflict-free counsel in this case.
Is this a successive representation case?
I think...
Because your brief argues that it is.
Yes, and it...
But the... Ms. Rowland says this is really not a successive representation case in the way that's referred to in the case law.
And I would argue that it is successive in the sense that the representation of Washington, there was no overlap here in the time periods of representation. The representation of Washington had ended by any account years before the attorney entered an appearance. And the representation, although involving the same facts, was in some ways not in the same case. This was not an attorney who represented two individuals at trial on the same set of facts. Mr. Wood was the appellate attorney for Washington who handled the direct appeal, did not handle the trial proceedings or any subsequent 2255.
But isn't the theory that here you wouldn't want to do anything to undermine your prior client and that that therefore infringes your representation here, which is just like a concurrent representation problem?
And I think I would say to undermine your prior client, Mr. Woods would not have been prohibited from taking a contrary position here. His representation had ended. He's not a entity like the government who would be have his prior positions or arguments.
You have loyalty to your prior client, and that's going to cause you to pull your punches in your current representation if you still psychologically have that loyalty to the prior client. And the prior client, even though the case is over, there's always the possibility of a pardon. There's always the possibility of where you wouldn't want, if you're loyal to the prior client, wouldn't want to undermine the prior client's credibility.
And I think I would concede that that's a possibility here. Mm-hmm. There's no suggestion that there was any divided loyalties. In fact, Mr. Wood didn't remember.
Right. Well, I'm just asking which test applies, because your brief spent a lot of time on saying this is not a case where the Sullivan standard applies, and that's something I spent some time thinking about. But Ms. Rowland says, I think with some force, that that's really not the kind of case we're even talking about with successive representation as referred to in Mickens.
And I would say here, the standard that applies under these facts really doesn't matter for the outcome here.
Okay. That's really your alternative argument, which is, I understand that.
Isn't that what we did in Berkeley as well?
Yeah.
I mean, didn't we just sort of take the Sullivan argument on and found it lacking under Sullivan, didn't have to reach the issue of whether we go under Sullivan or Strickland? Isn't that your stronger argument?
I agree that the stronger argument is that
Sullivan standard applies
regardless. Yeah. Here, there is no conflict.
And if that's the case, what's the linchpin of your argument then? The plea colloquy?
I think that it is the representation by conflict-free counsel, Jennifer Wicks, coupled with the plea colloquy, coupled with the fact that there's no proffer here or suggestion in the record of actual division of any loyalties.
Should we be doing all this in the first instance here? And I know in Strickland claims we often remand for the fact-finding. It seems like there would be, even when the Sullivan standard applies, seems like you're asserting a lot of things about the facts. Ms. Rowland is as well. Should we be doing this in the first instance here?
I think that
to remanding?
This court can, despite the remand principles that have been set forth by this circuit, this court can and has in the past.
But what is it in the record that leads unalterably to the conclusion that that his claim fails under Sullivan? There has to be something that's just crystal clear from the record.
And again, I would point to a couple of things altogether. First, the fact that appellant had representation by conflict-free counsel who appeared in court on behalf of appellant before a plea offer was ever extended and handled the plea proceedings. The Rule 11 colloquy makes clear that under oath appellant stated that he was not forced or coerced or pressured into this plea.
On your first point, just because another counsel is involved, we can ignore the problem. I'm not sure of the force of that first point.
I think the force is that to the extent that there was, some conflict that would limit at some point Mr. Wood's ability to cross-examine this speculative witness, that there was no indication from the government that the government ever intended of calling in based on that witness's testimony, Washington's testimony at his trial.
Is that right? Could counsel, just by having someone else sit at the table with him and cross-examine Mr. Washington, relieve himself of the obligation that he has to Washington? By bringing in another counsel to sit at the table with him?
I think it is possible. And here you have conflict-free counsel coupled with the fact that appellant was well aware of this possible potential conflict brewing and heard the representations regarding the prior representation through the course of a series of status hearings spanning 7 months before the plea proceeding, never complained about.
I think we have to take it as a given that he was not pressured to plead.
Right.
I mean, he stated that under oath. So where's the actual conflict? They know, we're talking about, my colleagues were talking about remanding for a hearing. You know, we're the only circuit that, allows ineffective assistance to be raised on direct appeal. Every other circuit in the country requires it to be raised by 2255. So, but we have that, we have the rule, and I guess we have to comply with it. I have one question, which is, I really haven't focused on the cases, but the successive representation cases, how many of them, if any, involve a guilty plea?
The successive representation post-Mickens?
The conflict arises in the context of a guilty plea.
I am not aware specifically
none of,
a case
cases
that involves a guilty
plea.
Someone
is talking about the representation at trial and presuming a prejudice. I just can't think of the cases in which what we have here, which is the entry of a guilty plea with the defendant getting up and saying, I wasn't pressured and I did it, you know, and throwing himself in the mercy of the court.
Yes, and I would just conclude with, I think in addition to the Rule 11 colloquy, you have the letter at sentencing where the defendant, again, explains his reasons for why he chose to enter into the guilty plea. And the record forecloses, again, a possibility that Mr. Wood was so loyal to Washington when at sentencing Mr. Wood argued that appellant should receive a more favorable sentence because, unlike Washington, who didn't accept responsibility and tried to cast blame on the missing, you know, person at trial, appellant had accepted responsibility. I think all of that together indicates that even if there was this potential for a conflict here, there was no actual conflict with an adverse effect.
Even if not pressured, though, counsel could have advised, plead guilty, right? And that advice might have influenced the defendant's choice, right? And if that advice was influenced by a conflict in loyalty, I mean, I'm supposing a few things here, but I'm not sure saying I wasn't pressured is the same thing as saying that I wasn't affected by my lawyer's advice. Those are two different things, right?
And that is, I will say, not the allegation that appellant has raised here.
Mm-hmm.
The allegation is one of pressure or coercion. And again, I would point to the fact that there was conflict-free counsel who was brought in and specifically stated to consult and advise on the plea proceedings itself, and that, you know, were there some argument that one attorney's advice could have been influenced, I think here there is just no showing of an adverse effect or a lapse in the representation
that
appellant
received. But as a legal matter, is that legally significant in your mind? If they had pled it that way, that the advice given at that time was tainted because of his desire to avoid problems with conflict, would that change things?
I would again say that it wouldn't change the fact that this record shows that there was
no. I'm asking you a legal question.
I think that it's possible that, again, a lapse in representation is where you advance another.
I'm a little bit confused about the sequence. When in this continuum from the arraignment until the sentencing, when is it that Wood dropped out? Dropped out of the picture.
Wood did not. He did not
withdraw. I know he didn't withdraw, but he didn't show up for what?
So there were a series of hearings that were handled at different times, and there was never. I think Woods was present in court on both ends of the proceeding, both at sentencing and at the first hearing. There were a series of hearings that were handled at times by other members of Woods' law firm, Mr. Davies, and then you had Jennifer Wicks, who specifically was not affiliated with Mr. Woods' firm in any way.
Is there any indication that she was involved in negotiating the plea?
The only thing the record indicates is that she appeared on behalf of appellant prior to a plea offer ever being extended, that she handled the plea colloquy and said that she was brought in to consult and was the attorney, one of the attorneys who executed the plea paperwork with appellant.
Let me put it another way. Is there any indication that Mr. Wood was the person who negotiated the plea?
There are indications that the record shows that the government extended a plea offer to Mr. Wood. There are then a series of hearings that don't involve any information about negotiating that plea offer, but where members from Mr. Wood's firm are requesting additional time because they would like a pre-plea guidelines calculation to be able to understand what...
But not him. He's not involved in those hearings. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Wood, I don't believe, appears in person at any of those interim status hearings.
Was he with that firm when he represented Washington?
I do not have that information.
You said a couple times this record shows the problem, but then we're all sorts of speculation about this, that, and the other thing, and who did what and said what. The record's incomplete, right? That's in a case like this. You said a number of things about the record doesn't show. Well, of course the record doesn't show because there hasn't been a hearing to determine what happened and why it happened. So on the face of the record, obviously those things don't appear. It's a real problem. Maybe I'm just making a point. I think it's a real problem to make these kinds of factual findings, in essence, in the first instance here. So,
and again, I would just point to what the record does show. The government believes is sufficient to show that there was no adverse effect here.
But there's a possibility that a fully developed record might cast doubt on some of the things that the incomplete record as of now shows. I might agree with you that the record as of now supports your point, but I'm not sure the record's as full as it would be if the issues that you're talking about were actually inquired into by the district court.
And again, I think I would respond to that just with the possibility that speculative, inferences could rise to the level of a colorable conflict is not a sufficient showing under this circuit's law to entitle an appellant to a remand for an evidentiary hearing. And here, government believes that appellant has not made the requisite showing.
It would still be open to him, I take it. I mean, because we're dealing with a record that was, as Judge Kavanaugh pointed out, the record that was made during the plea negotiations and the sentencing. But it would still be open to him, I think, to file a 2255 alleging additional evidence.
It's possible, depending on whether it would be a timely file 2255,
Well, as you know, I agree with Judge Randolph's earlier observation about the 2255, but I'm a lone voice.
Thank you. Well, we'd ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
To conflict-free counsel, after the conflict was revealed, Mr. Wood or his associate appeared in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 status hearings at which they sought continuances so that plea negotiations could continue. Mr. Wood and his associate negotiated the plea agreement and signed the plea agreement. Ms. Wicks appeared on the day of the police saying that she's standing in for Mr. Wood and saying, I was actually brought in to consult with Mr. Wright and to be present. I am not a member of Mr. Wood's firm, so I don't share the conflict. I think it's clear from that record that Mr. Wood and his associate negotiated between the defendant and the government for a plea agreement and made the arrangement.
Wood signed the plea agreement, did you say?
Pardon me? Mr. Woods' associate in his law firm signed it, and he signed it Matthew Davies for Doug Wood. But they're in the same firm. Ms. Wilkes did not sign the plea agreement, and she did not.
Given what the plea colloquy said, I'm puzzled why you didn't argue that in fact counsel here had given advice that was somehow tainted with the conflict instead of arguing that he pressured or coerced him.
What we mean by that is
that plea colloquy is a problem. It's a serious problem for your case.
Going to trial was not an option. It was not It was not on the table because Mr. Wood was adversely affected by his actual conflict. He couldn't investigate the case. He couldn't bring witnesses or cross-examine witnesses because he had that conflict. So when we say, you know, he was pressured, he was left no option. I don't mean that he was, you know, held down to the table and said, if you don't do this, I will do something to you. I just mean Mr. Wood could not take the case to trial and did not present that as an option to him.
So was Mr. Wright answering truthfully at the plea colloquy when he said he was not pressured or coerced, that he was satisfied with his counsel? Was he answering truthfully there? I think earlier you indicated
you know,
that perhaps he wasn't.
I can't say whether that's truthful or not truthful. He didn't have any other choice. Was he pressured or coerced? Well, I don't think his...
You're saying his counsel told him that he had no other choice?
Right. His counsel did not do the things or present the options that would allow him to have a trial because his lawyer couldn't. He couldn't cross-examine the witnesses. He couldn't call the witnesses. He couldn't even investigate the case.
Couldn't he have his co-counsel do that? I thought we just...
Well, he didn't have co-counsel. I mean, he had a lawyer from his own firm.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose he could have...
Who took an active role in this throughout, right?
Who took an active role?
Wow.
He stood in for him at sentencing, I mean, his status hearings, mm-hmm. and he actually signed the document. But they, you know, they were... Mr. Matthews is an associate at Mr. Woods' firm. The question...
May I ask you, I'm looking at the, I guess it's JA 26, the joint appendix, or the, well, the appendix that you filed, 26? You said something that triggered, this is the statement of offense, and I guess that's preceded by the plea agreement. But there's no signatures on page 26, and there's no signatures on page 21 and defendant's acceptance in 22. You were saying there was a signature of someone other than Mr. Wood on these?
Yes.
Why don't we have the signature page?
And the government included the correct version in their appendix at page 7.
Oh.
I apologize for that.
Okay.
Do you think we know enough to resolve this one way or another here? I mean, as you can tell from my questions, I'm very reluctant to the...
I think that you do know enough because you know that Mr. Wood represented the co-defendant who pointed the finger at Mr. Wright, and he had a continuing duty of loyalty to Mr. Washington. That is an actual conflict that adversely affects his performance on behalf of Mr. Wright. When he has a duty of loyalty to the co-defendant, he can't give his 100%, his all, to Mr.
If it goes back to the district court, what will happen? And so your alternative in the conclusion, if the court finds the record does not conclusively, the record should be remanded to the district court for an evidentiary hearing. What would happen at that evidentiary hearing?
It's hard to say because Wood still couldn't talk about Washington's confidences. So he still couldn't say, well, Mr. Washington didn't say anything that would affect mm-hmm. Mr. Wright. I suppose Mr. Wright could testify about whether whether Mr. Wood gave him any options, investigated the case.
And Wood would talk about why. Would Wood talk about why he did certain things and didn't do certain things?
Well, without revealing any confidences, he could.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble, I think, is in getting into the prejudice inquiry. You know, how exactly did this prejudice Mr. Wright? And, you know, would Mr. Wright, you know, have prevailed at a trial? Those sorts of things, because those are not a proper inquiry.
Right. Well, I'm assuming even I'm taking out that part of the of the Strickland analysis.
I think it's sort of tricky to distinguish between those questions about what exactly would did or didn't do, and as the courts have stated, the problem here is largely in the paths not taken, and you know when there are these conflicts. I know I'm not being very helpful. It's a little hard to imagine what they would be talking about at an evidentiary hearing. We know that Mr. Wood would not have been able to call Washington as a witness, and he would not have been able to cross-examine Washington if the government had chosen to call Washington.
Let me ask you, would the defendant, would you represent for the defendant that if it went back for an evidentiary hearing, the defendant would waive the attorney-client privilege?
That
would
my
Mr.
client
Wood,
would?
Mr. Wood?
I don't know the answer to that. Generally, when you bring an ineffective assistance claim, you automatically waive.
You automatically waive, don't
right.
you?
When you bring a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, you do waive, and this is a variant of that. So I think that
it's a variant. You're claiming conflict and actual prejudice, and so.
Well, I'm not.
You're not.
No, sir, because I don't have to. I am claiming that the conflict was an actual conflict because it adversely affected his loyalty to my client, but I'm not claiming prejudice, which is a different matter, because prejudice is not part of this inquiry at all.
In your brief, you said, but for the pressure that Mr. Wood put on, the defendant would have gone to trial.
Yes, he would have. Yeah. But you don't need to make that finding, that ruling, in order to reverse this case, this conviction, because
if you went to trial, let's suppose we send it back.
Okay.
And the district judge says, well, there was an actual conflict, and so you can withdraw your plea and go to trial. At the trial, could the colloquy that he testified, that he entered into with the judge under oath, be introduced against him?
I haven't looked at that law with regard to this case. My recollection is that the government can introduce prior inconsistent statements such as those at a guilty plea. But I'm sorry that I didn't look into that in this case.
You have to show.
These are some of the puzzles that come to my mind, some of the questions that come to my mind when you're dealing with a conflict alleged that has resulted in a guilty plea,
right,
as opposed
right.
to a trial.
Well, but those kinds of questions really go to harm. Well, could he win if he went back to a trial? Because after all, they would, you
That's
know.
A different question. There's two questions. There's adverse
okay.
effect on the performance,
yes.
and then there's affecting the result of the trial.
Yes.
Under Sullivan, you still have to show, correct me if I'm wrong, adverse effect on the performance.
Exactly.
And So adverse effect on the performance requires knowing why certain things were done and weren't done by the counsel. When these things go back, now I'm going to switch back to Strickland. When they go back on Strickland claims to the district court, is it the attorney and the counsel, who have a competing recollections of why they did certain things?
I'm sorry, is it who has?
The attorney and the counsel. The attorney and the client, sorry. Yeah. And I don't see why this wouldn't be anything other than a variant on a Strickland kind of evidentiary hearing. You wouldn't be looking for a change in the result, but you would be looking for whether the conflict adversely affected the performance.
I Yes, I think that's right. But I think what you would come to is that Mr. Wood would say, I represented Mr. Washington in this very case, and I would not be able to call him as a witness because I can't...
Well, he might not have said that.
Examine him. Well...
We don't know what he would have said. That's my point.
I guess my point is you don't have to ask him, because we know that if the government called him as a witness, Mr. Wood could not cross-examine him. Mm-hmm. He could not.
But Jennifer Wicks could.
Well, that's a different lawyer. I mean, he could... That would be great if he got a new trial and Jennifer Wicks could be his lawyer, but Jennifer Wicks was not retained by Mr. Wright, and he was not... She didn't investigate the case.
She signed a form that said she was retained. What do you mean he was...
Jennifer Wicks?
Yeah, says retained. I saw it.
Okay. I'm not sure about that form, but he retained Mr. Wood, and Jennifer Wicks is not part of Mr. Wood's firm.
Yeah.
And Mr. Wood cannot simply subcontract once he's been retained.
It's on page, I don't know what the page number is, of the government's appendix. It's almost the next to last. Oh,
okay. Yeah. Well.
But there's the form.
Yes, I see it. Thank you. Perhaps if they had gone to trial, Ms. Wicks could, but Doug Wood can't, an attorney cannot simply subcontract. If a defendant hires someone and then he says, well, I have a conflict, so I'm subcontracting to some law firm outside my firm, the defendant is certainly entitled to say no, or Ms. Wilkes was not...
That happens all the time.
She was not retained to investigate the case.
It's very common, if in federal courts anyway, that if you're a criminal defense lawyer in the Eastern District of Virginia, it used to be anyway when I was practicing, you had to hire local counsel. And the local counsel participated in the in the trial, and of course the defendant had to agree to it, but it was the local counsel was chosen by the criminal defense attorneys. So you call it subcontracting.
The record is very clear that Ms. Wilkes was brought in after the plea was negotiated to handle the plea colloquy. She was not brought in to investigate the case, to evaluate whether the strength of the government's evidence, the strength of the defense. That was not her role in this case.
How do we know that?
How do we know that? Because the record shows at every status hearing, Mr. Woods' firm discussed the plea agreement. They negotiated it. They signed it. She came in to handle the Rule 11 colloquy.
The way that you've argued this today, as I understand it, if there were a remand, wouldn't the key issue be whether counsel advised Mr. Wright that trial was not an option? Did he say, you can go to trial or you can plea? That to me, seems to be the crux of the matter. Before this morning, I was under the impression go ahead.
I'm sorry. It's really about whether Mr. Woods' duty to Mr. Washington affected his representation.
And if he had told him, you can go to trial or you can take this plea.
Well, a lawyer doesn't just say you can go to trial or take a plea. That he says a lawyer has a much larger duty to that, to investigate the case, to evaluate the government's evidence,
but
to evaluate the defense evidence.
But the way you said this earlier, maybe you're believing it, but the way you said this earlier, you said he had no option. Mr. Wright had no option to go to trial. Where did that come from?
Okay.
It must have come from his lawyer. I thought that's what you were saying. Or were you saying his own independent judgment was that he had no options?
No, I was saying that Mr. Woods' loyalty to the co-defendant prevented him from doing the kinds of things that he would do if he went to trial.
Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. But
well, he certainly couldn't. He was hampered in his investigation by Mr. Washington's things told in confidence. He was couldn't call Washington as a witness, and he couldn't cross-examine Washington if Washington had been called as a witness by the government, which is really not far-fetched, because Washington's testimony, while it was intended to exculpate himself, it did. He implicated himself and Mr. Wood.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted.